Once upon a time, in a world with faith and fairness, there was something hidden.
Down the boundary! He's gonna go! Broadcast lead!
Pitch on the way from Mikolajczyk.
Swing and a miss! Mikolajczyk gets the strikeout! And for the first time in school history, the Bearcats are going to the Super Regionals!
Get ready for a next level show.
Hello and welcome to Chasing the Cup. I'm your host, Jason Barfield. We're down to the final four of our Bearcat bracket, and today we're going to talk 1996 baseball and the upset the Bearcats had over Miami. Brent Bubella is going to join us. He was the catcher on that team. He was the MVP of the Southland Conference Tournament the week before that Miami game. He's going to talk about everything that went into that Miami game and how they were able to put it all together despite a few things not going their way in the weeks leading up to it. All of that coming up next here on Chasing the Cup. Season tickets for the 2020 football season are on sale now. Secure your seats today and ensure you have the best view as the Cats look to claim a Southland Conference title. The Bearcats will play five games at Bauer Stadium this season, and as always, your season ticket will guarantee your spot at the Battle of the Piney Woods. You won't want to miss the action at NRG Stadium as the Bearcats look to make it 10 straight wins over SFA. To purchase your tickets, log on to GoBearcats.com/tickets or call the Athletic Ticket Office at 936-294-1729, and we will see you at Bauer Stadium this fall. Eat 'em up, Cats! And welcome back to Chasing the Cup. Jason Barfield here, and I'm now joined by Brent Bubella, who was a member of the 1996 Sam Houston baseball team, famously that knocked off Miami in the first round of the NCAA regional. Brent, thank you for joining us here today.
Hey, what's up, Bearcats? Good to be here.
Hey, we've been needing to talk some baseball. It's that time of year, and I think a lot of people have been missing it. And so let's talk a little bit about that 96 team. But first off, just kind of give me a little bit of your background, what you're doing now professionally, and then you know, talk to me about the process of choosing Sam Houston and, you know, how you ended up becoming a Bearcat.
Sure. So now currently I'm actually a medical device sales rep, and I work for a big company called Becton and Dickinson, also known as BD. And so what I do right now is I sell like in the oncology world, and I sell ports and things like that. And also on the side, I've actually, I've always been a guy who kind of likes to invent things and do little things like that. And I partnered with a company called Ace Sports, and I helped develop this new product called Ace Grip, which is out. So it's kind of getting me back in the baseball world, softball world and all that. And my oldest daughter is on a national team, the Texas Bombers. And so it's been kind of cool. I'm getting right back in the game and coaching again. And it's been a lot of fun.
So you're a softball dad now, huh?
I am. I have a 12 or a 14 and a 12 daughters. And then I have a 10-year-old son. So, they're all playing and active in sports and stuff. And my oldest is one that now it's kind of gotten to that level where we're having to do the big time, you know, travel ball and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And, the Texas Bombers group has been a really cool group for her. And it's been a lot of fun. These girls are really something.
How hard is it to be a parent watching your kids play?
So I actually kind of like it. It's one of those things where I coach a lot at home, and, you know, I actually do coach all of my kids' teams, and this Texas Bombers group, it was funny because one of the coaches took a job with Easton, and so she was curious, or she wasn't sure about how much time she was going to be able to spend with the group last year. And she had played, it's Kristen Coyas, and she had played shortstop at A&M a couple years prior. And so they asked me to kind of help. And so I went from being a sideline dad to back into the game again and coaching and being involved that way. But the coolest thing is, like, with that group, I just deal with the catchers and a little bit of the outfielders, but mostly the catchers and first basemen. And, you know, my daughter's a shortstop, third baseman, so I don't have to deal much with her. I just watch, you know.
It's tough.
My
son, when he was doing the Little League stuff, I couldn't do the coaching. We just clashed, and he didn't want to listen to anything I had to say. And so I turned it over to the coaches. I'd go out and I'd throw a little BP at practice from time to time, but that was about the extent of my involvement. It's funny. He's a freshman now playing soccer. And so he'll tell me, he said the other day, he's going, "Yeah, Dad, I never really thought about it a lot, but you've got a lot of experience in athletics and you have an understanding of what."
Yeah,
I know. I've been telling you that since you were like five, but you know.
Well, even some of the brightest minds in the game, they'll say the same thing. There comes a point where you have to give your kids away because they don't see it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so true, man. It's so true. It's crazy.
Well, let's talk about your Bearcat career. How did you end up at Sam Houston?
So it's a funny story because I started in JUCO. And so I was at Tyler Junior College my sophomore year. And actually, I didn't do real well. I ended up hitting, I want to say like 240, 248 or something like that. It wasn't very good. And I ended up backing up a kid kind of thing. I was kind of like the backup catcher type deal. And just worked hard and was always that type of player. And it was one of those things where I got voted team captain that year. As a backup, right? Which is kind of crazy. And then I had gotten, the Apache Award there, which is kind of given away for like hard work and all that kind of stuff. And so, Coach Skeeters had called in, you know, a lot of the guys off that team had signed and already in April had, you know, first signing day or whatever had signed. And so, the end of year reviews for Coach Skeeters came up with his players and, you know, that's in May, and he came off probably the worst season ever that he's ever had there that year. I think they finished last, and so just so turned out, his catcher at the time came in and said, "Look, I'm not coming back." And so the catcher was young, and so he ended up going to a JUCO. Well, it blew Skeeters away a little bit because he wasn't expecting it, and so then he got on the phone and started calling people. And he just so happened to call my coach at Tyler, John Groth. And so what John Groth had all of us send letters to everywhere. You know, he said, "Look, I'm not going to call schools for you. You're going to have to go out and hustle it yourself. But when schools call, I'm going to talk to them about you if they do," which was fair. Right. And so he kind of taught us how to take care of things ourselves. Well, Coach Skeeters had gotten a letter from me, you know, about the possibility of going there and stuff like that. And so anyway, so he actually called about Coach Skeeters called Coach Groth about the starter that year who he had known. And I guess he recruited him out of high school. And that kid had happened to go to already sign with Pan Am. And so Skeeters was kind of like, "Oh man, well, okay." You know, and as he was about to hang up, he goes, "Well, hey, I got this letter from this other kid, this other catcher you had there." And so Coach Groth said, "Yeah, you know, he's a pretty good catcher. He does a good job back there, a good leader, works real hard. Didn't swing the bat real well this year, though, you know, that kind of thing." And he said, "But the funny thing about the kid is that, you know, even though he was our backup, the team voted him team captain." And Coach Skeeter said, "Wow, I got to have a guy like that." And so he called me, and just so happened, I was looking at a D2 school, possibly going there, and offered me a spot and actually gave me a pretty good deal to come there and off of hitting 240. And then, you know, the next year I came in and I won the conference batting title, you know, and that's where I always tell people, I'm like, "Look, man, you never know what's going to happen. You know, there could be just one little thing that can happen that can kind of jar you a little bit and take you to the next level." And so it just so happened, everything got in sync and I went from hitting 240 to hitting, I think I finished the year at 391.
Wow.
You know, and I mean, at the Division I level, which is wild, you know, but so luckily that's how I got to Sam Houston, was because I was like the second choice, I guess you could say.
You know, when I talk to guys about that team and, you know, we're kind of getting in and working on an extended project, by the way, you hit 382 that year. I just
that was before the playoffs.
Okay.
I mean, I remember going up against Miami and it having 401 or something like that on the board, and I was like, "Man, I wish I could take a picture of that." I think after the regionals, I think I finished 391, but that was 382 as a regular season.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow.
But no, when I talk to people about that team, it's funny because people laugh first and they're like, man, that was an interesting team. And, that was also my freshman year. And in fact, my roommate at orientation was Tommy Cliff. So I knew Tommy, and, so I got to watch, you know, I watched a lot of that 96 season at Holloman Field, and actually was at the regional and was at the Miami game and the UCLA game. And you know, we'll get into a few specifics, but just what was that group of guys like?
So the wild thing about that group was they were all, not all, most of them were from small towns.
Yeah.
And most of them came from blue collar families. And not that anything's wrong with white collar families, but what I'm saying is they were tough. And when I mean tough, I mean tough like the kind of guys that you would see it sitting at the bar and you'd walk up and you'd have a conversation with and instantly become a friend of theirs. And then tough from the standpoint of if you ever got in a brawl, you never had to worry because you knew they would be there with you, you know, swinging with an iron fist. You know what I'm saying? That's the kind of guys they were. They just grew up that way.
Yeah.
And it was just such a great gel that when because Mosquito's having that year that he had the year before, he brought in so many JUCO players that year. And, you know, we came in and actually, you know, stepped kind of right into where there wasn't a lot of young players on that team. I mean, Tommy Cliff ended up, like you said, you brought him up. He played a lot as a freshman, but you know, most of the team was either made up of JUCOs or kids that had upperclassmen that had been there.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't young, you know, and I think that was the big thing also is that we were a little bit older. And then the fact of the matter is that everybody kind of came from that background and it was just such a sit by the campfire kind of group. Just, I mean, still to this day, if we were to all get together, we wouldn't have seen each other in say 20 years. It would be like we didn't skip a beat. I mean, everybody liked everybody. It was just a really good group, good bunch of guys.
You know, and I'm looking down the roster right now, and you know, I think back to like this year's team and the teams over the last couple of years, and how big the Woodlands, Spring, Klein. I mean, it feels like half the team just about is from that area. Looking at you guys' team, I mean, it's Yoakum, it's Weimer, it's El Campo, it's, you know, there's not a lot of Spring, Shiner, you know, I mean, it's
right, it's Weimer,
yeah. Why, I mean, you know, it's guys, it's small town, like you said, it's you know, hardworking guys, and you know, that was kind of what the makeup of this team was, wasn't it?
It was, and that's why I think everybody always talks about you got to have talent, right? You have to have talent to win, but you also have to be able to play together. And sometimes you see teams where they're loaded with talent, but they can't win, right? Where this team had talent and everybody believed in themselves, but maybe not the talent that people would have thought to be like a big league type talent type deal. But when the top 9 or 10 were on the field, we could play with anybody. I mean, that was just one of those things because we had some good arms. And even with the arms that we had, you know, Greg Kubesch was a freshman that year and didn't pitch that much. And, you know, the next year he ended up pitching on the Olympic team.
Yeah.
And then you had Steven Perhoda, who was a year older and had just left, who was a very dominating figure. So you look at if you would have mixed one of those two guys in there as well, it's just crazy the arms that we had and just the overall, you know, we were pretty fine tuned. I mean, Skeeters worked really hard on making sure we didn't make mistakes on the little things. You know, it wasn't like we were going to make those flamboyant type plays, even though some guys could. It was more like, hey, look, we're not going to screw up on the basics. And he drilled it hard. And I'm a big guy on that now because of him, I believe, because it proved to be successful that way with what we had.
Yeah. One of the things that, you know, when you look at that team and just kind of, it was a bit of an up and down season for you guys. And, you know, y'all ended up finishing the year in fourth in the league. But the way the regular season ended, and, you know, I'll let you kind of tell the story, but y'all ended up having to forfeit the final weekend series of the year and really didn't know if y'all were even going to play in the conference tournament. So tell me about what led into all of that.
So I'm not going to really get into all the specifics of the names involved.
I could tell you
that probably the only two that weren't involved were Ronnie Thames and myself. And I'm not trying to say that we were goody two shoes or anything, but the fact of the matter is Ronnie was living in Livingston and I don't know where I was, but we weren't, like, we didn't have cell phones, which we could connect to everybody the way we can now, but basically it was most of the team. And apparently, just allegedly, let's just say that there was a party that was held on Vicky Lane, which if you're from Huntsville, you know Vicky Lane very well. And so there was a party there and it was late. I think some cops were involved. To make a long story short, Coach Keeters is a legend, obviously, around there in many places. And it didn't take long for the chief to get a hold of Keeters and let him know that there was some issues and some of his players were involved, right? So Coach Keeters, being what he is, as far as, you know, he's a disciplinarian, and there was no doubt about it. He was gonna rule a little bit on this thing. And so we ended up, our school had just let out, and that's why there was a party. And so with the school letting out, then the next day we were all supposed to meet at McDonald's to have breakfast, and then we were gonna get on the bus. And we were going to, I believe, take off to UTA, is where it was at Arlington. And so we found out that morning, somebody came in, I can't remember who it was, and said, look, hey, we may not be going. And we're like, what happened? And so there were some things that were said about, you know, the night before or the two nights before, whatever it was. And so anyway, what had happened with Coach Keeters, out of disciplinary actions, forfeited that series. And when he forfeited that series, I mean, what ended up happening is we were playing UTA, and UTA wasn't going to make the conference tournament. So when we forfeited the series, it gave UTA three wins, which they wouldn't have beat us, right?
Yeah.
And so it gave them three wins, and then it gave us three losses, and it moved Nichols out of the tournament. And so what ended up happening, UTA came in, Nichols went out. Well, obviously, if you're Nichols, you're pretty upset about that whole deal.
Yeah.
For one, so they raised a lot of cane about that, and they tried to get us suspended from the tournament so that they could get in. But fortunately, we were too high up in the rankings, I believe, to where it knocked us to fourth. But we should have been like second or something, I believe, if that wouldn't have happened. But anyway, so as it knocked us back in the ranks, it knocked Nichols out. They were upset. Then it was said, well, Coach Keeters and Coach McBroom were good friends, so it was a setup so that Coach Keeters could get Coach McBroom in. I mean, there were all kinds of things that were brought, this black cloud brought around this thing. So then we were sent home and basically not knowing whether or not we were going to even be able to go to the conference tournament. And so right before the conference tournament, we got the clearing, I guess, for us to show up and go. And that's basically the start of it.
Yeah.
So, and then when we got to the conference tournament, you know, the conference tournament was one of those things where it was pretty wild to start also. I mean, we started out against UTSA not doing very good. And I want to say, I don't know if you have the record in front of you on that, but the score, but I want to say it was like 7-2. And then we were down and didn't look like we were coming up. Everybody was kind of frustrated with the situation. I don't remember who started that game, but he got hit a little bit. And then we made a few errors. Well, then Jamie DeBruin stepped out on the mound. I don't remember him, but
yeah,
but he was from Port Lavaca, another small town, right? And so Jamie came in, and being a catcher, it's one of those things for me. I love being able to be a part of the game as much as I'm able to, because you can learn and see so many things and have so many stories about it. But Jamie came in throwing anywhere from 93 to 95 miles an hour that day. And it could have been probably his best game of his career. I'm not sure, but the guy was dominating. And when I mean dominate, Jamie threw a heavy ball. And catchers know what I'm talking about when I say a heavy ball, because it comes in and you feel it. Like when it hits your mitt, nobody knows why, Nobody knows how to throw one, but there are certain kids who have that heavy ball.
Yeah.
Well, Jamie dominated that game. And I mean, to a point to where at the end of the game, when I went, I had to ice my hand. My finger, my index finger was so swollen, I couldn't even bend it. He was bringing that kind of gas. And so there were some key plays. I remember Thames, we turned to like a 3-2-3 double play, you know, and we scored our runs. And then Tanner came in off the bench, I believe, and got a big base hit to score the tying run. And we came back right at the end and won the game. And I mean, that right there for us was a real big turning point, because we could have packed it up, you know, midway through the game when we were doing so lousy. But for some reason, when De Bruin took the mound, it was like a freaking spark went off.
Yeah.
And then we beat Southwest the next day, I think 2-1.
Mm-hmm.
And then that next day, I think we drew Northeast.
Yeah.
And
Northeast.
When we drew Northeast, Louisiana, they were the
conference champs. They had gone 21-9 in the regular season.
And they had some studs on that team. I mean, I want to say they had quite a few kids that were drafted that year. I mean, we were always like their nemesis, though, it seemed like, because we battled, we had really, really good hard battles when I was playing. But we came out that day, and I remember it was during the day, and I think we 10-run ruled them. I mean, it was a
11-1,
really legit.
Yeah.
11, okay, so yeah, it was legit. Boom, we came right at you. And at that point, I remember there were talks about this Cinderella team. You know, like we were kind of like this Cinderella team that came out of nowhere. And there was a guy on the team, I don't know, you remember Wes White?
Yeah.
You remember that name?
Yeah.
So Wes played third base. And Wes was one of those guys, he had a really, really legit glove. I mean, really legit. And so I'll never forget Wes saying, "What are these guys calling us a Cinderella team for? Yeah, I've been saying we were good since day one." Kind of guy he was. The guy's like, "What Cinderella team? We ain't no Cinderella team. We should be in this thing," you know. So it was just kind of funny. But then after that, we drew Northwestern in that championship game, and that game was a battle the whole time. And you know, they'd go ahead, and we'd go ahead, and back and forth. And you know, the 10th inning, that game went 10 innings, and Ronnie Thames was a kid on that team that played first base for us. But Ronnie was a guy that he was just a legit hitter, had speed. Even though he was a first baseman, he was pretty quick. I mean, he was a quarterback that's the reason why Sam Houston got him, was because he wanted to play football.
Yeah.
And so he came actually his junior year and played football in the fall. And then we got him in the spring. So he was a quarterback. So, I mean, he's quick, you know? And so Ronnie had probably one of the worst tournaments that tournament that he's ever had. Like, the kid could flat out rake, and that he was maybe 2-for-something or whatever. Well, his last at bat when he came up in the 10th, I swear his at bat was maybe a 15 pitch at bat. And I may be elaborating a little bit, but I mean, it was one of the most masterful at bats you could have. I mean, he kept fouling off till finally he got a base hit up the middle, and then I got a chance to come up. And it's funny, because if you hear Skeeters tell this story about this, he says that, you know, he says, "Yeah, Ronnie gets on, and here comes Brent. I'm waiting to see what, you know, I'm trying to think what he can do. He hits the first guy third pitch." so then at that point, like, Coach Peters had always, again, I told you, he talked about fundamentals all the time. Well, one of the things he always talked about, him and Coach Gott. So Coach Gott coached third base, and he sent more runners home than I bet you anybody in the nation. And if it was close, he was going to send you. And so Coach Gott, like Coach Peters said, "I want Coach Gott to lead the nation in runners being thrown out at home plate." Like, that was his philosophy, right? So
yeah.
You knew when you got on second base that if that ball was hit to the outfield, you weren't stopping at third.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, like, for me this day and time, I have trouble a lot of times when balls are hit to the outfield and we're not scoring with two outs, you know, because that's so ingrained in my brain. And so, you know, Ronnie was on first base and I hit this ball. It was kind of – they brought in a big lefty and he was throwing pretty hard, and he brought it in on me a little bit. I kind of fought it off. And I always say it's one of those balls that kind of rolled and hit like 5 cups on the way down to the fence, you know, because it moved different directions and all that kind of stuff. And you know, Ronnie was able to come around and score from first. And when he slid into home, it was that whole, you know, dust safe kind of thing. And it was just, it was one of those wild, memorable moments in your life that, you know, very few people can experience that. And, you know, the fact of the matter, for me to be standing on second base, it was like it was awesome to be able to see that, you know, and, that team went crazy and it was just, so that's kind of what led us into, you know, it was kind of some down moments, and then we started to bring them up and just fight. And then, you know, and then we won. And the ironic story about this, hopefully I'm not getting too long winded on this thing.
Oh no.
But, you know, Coach Matt Degg has become a good friend of mine. And when we first met, it was one of those things to where people don't realize Coach Matt Degg was on the bench with Northwestern Louisiana on that game.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, it was Coach Van Hook. Or Korn, excuse me, Coach Van Horn, who was the coach of Northwestern, is now the coach at Arkansas.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, he was there, you know, for that game. And so when I first met Coach Degg, he vividly remembered that moment. And he said that bus ride home was terrible. So it's one of those things where I used to always send him a text every now and then. And, you know, when he gets some big wins or whatever, you know, hey, how was that bus ride home?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. You know, just kind of messing with him. Because he's such a good guy.
So you guys, you know, y'all didn't like the Cinderella label in the conference tournament. Well, you go to the NCAAs, and, you know, at the time, the format was a little different. 48 teams went. There were no super regionals. So there were 8 regions in the country with 6 teams there. So y'all are the 6th seed. You're playing Miami. 48 teams, y'all are probably team number 48 in the in the NCAA tournament.
48 and a half. Yeah.
So, I mean, as unlikely a team to make any kind of noise in this tournament. Well, just before we get into the Miami game, just what was that week like leading up to it, and just kind of what were you guys talking about heading to that regional?
So after we had the conference tournament, obviously there was a big buzz, right? And so we came home from Shreveport, that's where the tournament was at, and we got a few days off. And so that when they read off who was going where, that was on a Sunday. And I'll never forget my wife now, she was my girlfriend at the time, but her grandfather had passed away. And so I went to the funeral, and after the funeral, we went to his house. And so they were like, hey, we're going to go see, you know, who's Brent playing, you know. And so everybody kind of lined up around the TV, because it's not like it is back then, was not like what it is now.
Yeah.
You know, it was a big deal. You're sitting there, okay, we're watching. We're going to, you know, try to figure this thing out. And so I'll never forget them saying, you know, the number two nation or number two team in the country, you know, the Miami Hurricanes with the best hitting team and the whatever it was, you know, on ESPN, they were giving them. Is going to draw Sam Houston State. You know, everybody's like, whoa! In Austin. And I'll never forget just thinking, this is freaking awesome. You know, because granted, we're going into this thing not supposed to win. You know, so you don't really have a lot lingering there from a standpoint of a lot to lose. But for me, I'm about to be on the field and getting to play, you know, a team that, you know, we read about,
yeah.
Right? And we know, you know, we've heard all these things about them. I grew up thinking the Miami hat was awesome.
Yeah.
And I remember having that hat at home because I was at home for that funeral. And when I came back, I grabbed it and I showed up for batting practice the next day with that Miami hat on. And so, and it's ironic because Rossblock was one who would, Brian Rossblock, who's one of our big power hitters, we would throw BTs sometimes. We just, you know, do those kinds of things. And Skeeter's tried to keep it pretty light, you know, kind of leading into it. But he's throwing BP, and he put on my my Miami hat, and he's out there throwing BP in my Miami hat. Well, every now and then, I was pretty good at hitting the ball at the middle, and I hit him square in the back. He had the Miami hat on. So he took the hat and threw it to the side or whatever, you know. But it was one of those things to where we were just totally excited have the opportunity to you know, for one, do something that people didn't think we would do by going to the regionals and then face off against a team like that. And we honestly, I always thought we had a chance. But yeah, you just don't know until you get there. And I never have been real big on reading the press as far as how people are touted and all that kind of stuff, because, you know, that's all media and could be publicity more than what it really is when you get on the field. But when you get on the field, everybody's the same,
yeah,
you know? And so, anyway, that's kind of how we felt kind of going into it. And everybody was jazzed up and excited. And just, I don't think there was too much fear out there, to be honest with you. It was just more like, hey, man, this is going to be great. We get to play in front of a lot of people, and we're playing a really good team that we grew up watching on TV, you know?
You know, I think more gets made of this now than maybe back then, and maybe it's just because of the way social media is now, and there's a lot more conversation around games, but, you know, a team deciding to pitch off and, you know, not throw their ace in game one of a regional or something like that, and, you know, sometimes it can be looked as a sign of disrespect and stuff like that. And Miami threw a guy who only had 23 innings all year long. He'd only made 3 starts. And, you know, that's who started the game against you guys. Did y'all look at it that way, that maybe they were looking past y'all right from the start?
Well, for us, I mean, they're the number 2 team in the country. So even the back of their roster is pretty darn good.
Yeah. he could have played in the Southland, huh?
Well, I mean, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, they had Pat Burrell, who was the player of the year that year. And
yeah,
I mean, Alex Cora, who everybody knows who Alex Cora is now, but he was their shortstop. And I mean, you know, they had Morrison, who was their closer, who mm-hmm. was the closer of the year. I mean, they had so much talent on that team. It was unbelievable, you know? So, you know, the pitcher was a part of it, but we didn't care. Honestly, for us, we were glad to be there. So we didn't care who they put up there. And honestly, I didn't even know who their ace was anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't really look at it that deep.
They could have told you a name and it wouldn't have clicked to you that he, you know, who he was on, where he was on the roster, huh?
No, I mean, all I saw was those cool hats and those cool shirts and jerseys.
Yeah.
You know, that's for me, because that's what I grew up watching in the College World Series, right? So I didn't even really know who was underneath them, so to speak. It was more just the image of what it was,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Miami Hurricane.
So once y'all get into the game and you guys are playing with them, what was the mindset of the team as that game really kind of started to develop and started to push towards the late innings, and it was looking like you guys had a chance to really pull off something special?
So like when, again, Coach Skeeters' philosophy was you were expected to do the basics, right? There were no, oh, good try kind of thing. No, we worked hard at practice on making the fundamental plays and doing all the fundamental things that we needed to do. And so, you know, for him, he was the brains kind of behind the pitching, so to speak, from a calling pitches. You know, even though I was the catcher and, you know, Jeff Tanner and I, we split time most of the year. And so I was fortunate enough to catch this game. And so I got to be there to witness, you know, and just basically put the signs down. But you know, you had Daniel Boedeker and Kevin Hermes fill those games. And Skeeters called such a masterful game that it was one of those things that it was almost like, I don't know how to say it, like Picasso painting or something.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was just like, I'm sitting there with it and I'm like, whoa, this is, you know, because the thing was there were calls that he would make, and I was thinking to myself as I was dropping the sign down, that ain't going to work. That ain't going to work. And then it would, you know, and it was like, oh, my gosh, he really does know what he's doing over there.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, you look over at him, he's got this big old grin on his face. This is his time. You know, this is what he loves, you know. And so he wasn't throwing outside of those guys. He was burning them inside, and, you know, Hermes was a different type of pitcher than Boedeker. Boedeker threw more of a flat fastball, you know, in about the 86, 87, 88 mile an hour range. And he had a hard slider that usually every now and then would hang. He'd hang it one time a game.
Yeah.
And, you know, in that particular game, he hung it once to Pat Burrell, and Pat Burrell hit one that hit the moon,
just
right? But it was foul.
Crushed,
right?
The ball. Probably took out about 3 different cars out in the parking lot in the process.
It did. I want to say the next pitch or the pitch after, Skeeters called it again. And because, I mean, honestly, Boedeker never threw He only hung one a game, it seemed like.
Yeah.
But he hung two to the same batter, and it just so happened to be the player of the year. And he didn't hit this one foul. And I'll never forget when Pearl hit it, he kind of like tensed it in a way that he sat there and he watched it. And the umpire behind me was hollering at him, "Run! Run!" You know, like he didn't like the cockiness. You
yeah.
know, like those guys. Those umpires, it was funny because they liked us because they knew what we were. You know, I mean, we
yeah.
were just guys out there busting it. And so it was and the Miami players constantly complained about the pitches and all that because they weren't used to people coming inside on them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Hermes, with the way that he threw, he had a lot of movement on his ball, and he had a really good changeup. And so, you know, it was just two pretty good – they worked really well together. Even though they were both right-handers, they were two different types of right-handers, and it really kept them off balance big time. And then all we had to do was make the fundamental plays, and we did. I mean, we did. We made a lot of fundamental plays that game, and got a lot. He got a lot of ground balls, got a few pop flies, and of course a few bombs, but not enough. You know, not enough bombs.
What was that celebration like on the field? Because, you know, a lot of times first game of regional, you know, it's, you know, guys walk out and they shake hands and, you know, there's a little bit excited. You guys were pumped. They came flying out of that dugout on that last out. What was that like?
Well, you're talking about the team that was, like you said, 48.5 to get yeah. there or whatever, on a good day, right? And you just beat the number two team in the nation. And when we beat them, I mean, the thing that's so crazy about that game is you talked about the pitcher, you know, being in, you know, starting the wrong pitcher. But at the end of the game, they had Robbie Morrison in there.
Yeah.
And we beat Robbie Morrison, the number one closer in the nation. You know what I'm saying? And it just so happens that when Robbie came in, so the sequence of that kind of deal happened with Thames. He had a base hit up the middle, I believe, and he scored two runs, which I want to say, did it tie it? I think it made it 4-4 when Thames got that big hit.
Yeah.
Ronnie had a great regional tournament that year. Like I said before, he's a great hitter. But anyway, so he gets that hit, and then Skeeter's, again, everybody had to do everything fundamentally. So you had to know how to bunt on Coach Skeeter's team. If you didn't know how to bunt, he wasn't going to play you. And so I just so happened to – I always hit behind Ronnie. I hit fifth. Ronnie hit fourth, and Ross Block hit third. And so it just so happens that I come up because I got Big Hurt behind me, Jason Herta, who you know is going to hit it too, who hits with a lot of juice. And so so I got the bunt. Well, I learned early, and again, like I told you, I kind of hit close to 400. And the reason why was because some of these bunts that he would give us to do sacrifices, me being a left-handed hitter, I learned that, hey, on the stat book, right, that's not going to be an at-bat, right, when you do a sacrifice. So all Skeeters wants me to do is move the runner over, right?
Yeah.
But if I can get on base without getting out, that's a hit, right? And it gives us, you know, one fewer out. So what I learned was during that year is that if I pulled the ball with me, if I could read the defense a little bit, that I could pull it with me some and liable to get a base hit out of it. And I got quite a few base hits out of it. Instead of bunting at the third, I bunted it at the second base.
Yeah.
And so when he had me square, I did. I bunted it at second baseman. And back then you didn't have film, so they couldn't really, you know, see those types. Otherwise, they would have probably figured it out that I did that a lot.
There weren't any infield shifts and
right,
all
right.
of that.
And so what ended up happening was the second baseman, I'll never forget, he was D-line for the for first base, and he had to redirect his angle because I got it real good on the turf and hit it with enough steam to get it by the pitcher. And then he made a wild throw, and that made Ronnie and I, you know, it was a hit to first, and then the throw was wild, so I got to go to second, and Ronnie went to third. And then they didn't want to throw to Hurt, so they brought in Morrison, and they put Herta on, and then they brought Tommy Cliff in, right?
Yeah.
Tommy Cliff's up there, so here comes Tommy Cliff, right? Well, when Robbie Morrison threw his first curveball to Tommy Cliff, I swear it touched the sun and came down. I'm standing on a second watching it, and I'm like, oh, my God. And I looked at Cliff, and Cliff had a big old grin on his face, like, That was probably the best curveball I've ever seen in my life.
He didn't see a whole lot of curveballs like that playing at Yoakum.
No. So it just so happened he walked Cliff, and that put the winning run in. But anyway, it's funny story. So we had to battle through all of that. And then, you know, when we got down to the end in that game, they had runners on second and third with two outs. And I want to say it was like their six-hole hitter up. I mean, they had one of their better hitters up. And we got him to pop out, and that was the game. So it was on the line.
Yeah.
Right then with the tying run on third, winning run on second. And that's where all the excitement came out. You know,
struck out Burl in the ninth.
Did we?
Yeah. Struck out.
Yeah, we did.
Burl came to the plate, with a chance to tie the game. And he had already hit one that I think landed the inning before. I think it was still in the air for about two innings before it actually came down. But I got the strikeout of Burl in the ninth, and then set up the last out there.
Well, so it would have been the four-hole hitter probably, I think, because Pat was hitting three or four. But I remember when Burl struck out, it was on an inside fastball. Like, it was not one of those, you got the player of the year up right now, let's try to fart around with him a little bit and put it away from him. No. He went – Kevin Hermes went right at him.
Yeah.
All Yoakum, Texas of him. You know what I mean? It, every bit of Yoakum that he had, you know? So, and struck him out. I want to say looking.
I think so. I think you may be right. That was 24 years ago, but –
those kind of things, though, it's hard for me to forget, man, because, again, it's one of those things in life that it stays with you forever, you know?
So
it really does.
You know, and you look at that regional, and, you know, it's amazing. You know, that was the one game you guys won. Y'all come back, and, you know, the next day Texas gets y'all, and then the day after that you're eliminated by UCLA. But, you know, when you really dive into those games, how close y'all were in both of those ball games, to win in both of them. I mean, this wasn't a fluke win against Miami, and then y'all kind of bowed out in the next two. Y'all were right there in both those games against Texas and UCLA.
Yeah, and I mean, like with Texas, I mean, if you go back and look at that game, and Brad Verhoed is one of those guys, we hadn't mentioned him yet, but he was a center fielder out of Weimer. And Brad, when Brad ran down a ball in center field, his head and everything stayed so level that he was like, we used to call him a kamikaze out there, because he was quick for one, but his stride was so good, and his head stayed. So he went and got balls that I'd never seen gotten before, you know, that with players I'd played with prior. And so Brad earlier that year in San Antonio had went and got a ball, and they had chain link fence in the outfield, and he caught it off the fence in a way that I don't think he broke his nose, but it got him pretty good.
Yeah.
I don't think he might have stitched it up. I can't remember, but he looked like he had been in a big bar fight. And so, that particular game against Texas, you know, that was one where he went back on a fly ball, and I want to say there was runners on first and second. And he went up and caught the ball off the wall. Well, back then, Texas was all hard. There was no pad whatsoever out there. And he went up and he hit the wall so hard that it knocked him out. And when it did, he caught the ball. He didn't drop the ball. He caught the ball. But because of the way that it knocked him out, he laid there. I think it was Rossblock who went and got the ball out of his glove and threw it in, because runners are running like crazy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that kid who hit the ball actually ended up on third base, and he scored two runs, I believe. If you go back and look, I want to say it's probably how it worked out. So anyway, with that happening to Brad and him hitting the wall, I don't know if people know this or not, but Brad went up to bat the next at bat, the next inning when he came in. He didn't come out of the game. Again, he's tough. This kid is freaking he's tough.
Yeah.
He doesn't come out of the game. He stays in the game and comes up to bat and looks bad. I mean, I can honestly say he looks horrible at the plate, and for obvious reasons, right? And so when I threw my ball down to second base the next inning, Coach Skeeters comes walking out to the umpire and says, I got to replace my center fielder. And I looked up, and I didn't realize anything was had been really wrong with Brad.
Yeah.
But he was kind of out there kneeling. And he ran off the field, and, you know, we put a replacement in. And then, you know, we played or whatever. And then we get to the dugout. I'm like, hey, where's Proto? Everything all right? I said, man, they had to run him to the hospital. Really? You know, what's going on? I don't know. They ran him to the hospital. Well, that night, if we hadn't been in Austin, Brad could have died, because what happened is his brain was bleeding,
yeah,
you know, inside of his head, and they had to drill his head and get the blood out to relieve the pressure. And so, I mean, it was one of those things where it was, again, ups and downs, right? This team had a ton of ups and downs, and this was a down that we ended up losing that game 4-2. And, I mean, Ross Block hit a big two-run homer, which we probably could have, if that didn't happen to Brad, we probably win that game 2-1.
Yeah, but say, it was a 2-1 game. If he makes that catch, you're out of the eighth up 2-1. And instead, Texas flips it to a 4-2 game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was big. It was big. So, I mean, and then UCLA, when we played them, I mean, that was another thing where we came out, and UCLA had Troy Glaw.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about what they got with Troy Glaw. I mean, they had Troy Glaw. And I'll never forget looking. They said, yeah, it's that, look how tall that third baseman is. And I'm looking over there. That kid's like 6'5 or 6'6, and he's a rail. And they're like, oh, yeah, he's supposed to be a highly touted, you know, draft choice and all that. I'm like, really? You know, that guy's tall and skinny. You know what I mean? Who would have thought he'd been into being Troy Glaw? You know what I mean? But anyway, again, I didn't read into the press too much. But that particular game, I mean, we ended up, I want to say we went into the eighth inning with like a 6-run lead or something. I mean, we kicked UCLA's rear end up and down the field.
I think it was 8-4 going into the eighth inning, if I remember right.
Okay. And so we gave them probably 5 outs that inning. I know there were some mistakes we had made. You know, there were some balls that might not have shown up as mistakes, but, you know, some of our fielders had gotten to a point to where they were expected to make certain plays, and
yeah,
just things were off that day, you know, and we didn't make them, which is baseball. I mean, that's how it goes, man. Not everybody's perfect all the time. And we gave them that eighth inning, and man, and see, what's ironic about that is that inning we were visitors, and, I made the last out of that inning. I was DH in that game, and the pitcher struck me out on a slider off of my back knee. And I came in, and Coach Skeeters and I had a really good relationship in a way that he could scream and holler at me, and he knew it didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget sitting in the dugout and him screaming and hollering at me about how important that at bat was, and how, you know, and I'm looking at the scoreboard thinking, you know, we're up by 4.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? You know, why is he getting so upset with me about that? Well, you know, and then that happened.
Yeah, a 6-run eighth for UCLA.
One of those things. Just one of those things, man. You know, and then that happens to be the year, if you go back and look at it, you know, as the SEC Network put out that documentary on the walk-off of Warren Morris, right?
Yeah.
And they beat Miami, right? Well, the only loss Miami had that year was to us.
Yep. Yep.
You know, and that was, you know, Miami went all the way to the championship game of the College World Series and lost on a walk-off.
They bookended, you know, they bookended LSU. their postseason with a loss to you guys and a loss to LSU. And then...
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
Maybe, you know, and it's we're working on a documentary that I hope we can get put together, and certainly with everything that's going on right now, we've had to table a few things, and so I'm really looking forward to diving in and really telling the story of this team, with next year being 25 years, and college baseball in 1996 wasn't what it is now. And, you know, we're already finding how hard it is to find video from that game. And we've got a little bit of it, but, you know, there's no ESPN broadcast copies of that game against Miami. And there's no, you know, there none of that stuff exists. And so therefore this game never gets mentioned in any kind of a, you know, a national thing. But, you know, I think if you go back and you look at just the history of this tournament, this probably was one of, if not the biggest upsets in College World Series history. And, you know, the road to Omaha, and it was a very unlikely team just to be in the tournament and then to knock off a team like Miami. And I'm looking forward to getting the chance over the next year, hopefully, to really dive in and tell this story. And so I appreciate you coming on and kind of representing the 96 team as we're getting down into the final four voting of our bracket. And this 96 team is the representative going up against the super regional team of 2017 in our voting on Saturday. So I'm glad to be able to tell some of the story and appreciate you coming on and sharing some of that with us.
Oh, it's great to be in competition with them also, because, I mean, like I said before, Coach Matt Deggs has become a friend of mine. And then, you know, one of the kids, Clayton Harp, was a kid on that team who's from El Campo. And actually, you know, I ended up working with him, started working with him when he was 14. And so his dad was a mentor of mine growing up, coach of mine. So it's kind of cool to be able to go up against him in this situation. You know, that was obviously a huge feat when they did that. But this group right here, it's just hard to explain the types of characters. I really hope you can come out with this documentary, because what you're going to hear from some of these guys, it's just going to blow your mind about what this type of, what this team was. And I mean, when you think of guys like that just show up and work hard and good old boy type, that's what this kind of, this group was. It was just a mixture of a whole bunch of different types. And that'll be a really cool documentary if you can get that thing put together. I'm looking forward to that. I really am. It'll be a cool story.
Well, hopefully
for the whole year.
Yeah.
You know,
hopefully we can get that put together. And, cause I'm looking forward to hearing some more of these stories of that team. Like I said, that was my freshman year at Sam Houston. So I was getting to experience that. And, I worked in the press box that year watching those games. So that was a lot of fun. And, I think this is going to be a fun project to dive into.
Well, Coach Bobby Williams, he's done, he's changed a lot since Holloman Field with where the baseball team is playing now.
Yeah, the Don.
I mean, the facilities they have now versus what we had, oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
I don't know if people realize just what Holloman Field was like. And I'm hoping we can get out there. I want to do interviews out there and, you know, let the guys kind of get back out on the field a little bit and kind of walk it and tell some of the stories from that field and from practicing out there and everything like that. I think that'll be a lot of fun.
No, that'd be great. Yeah, that'd be great.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up here. Brent, really appreciate you coming on and, you know, look forward to catching up with all of you guys here over the next year as we look to put all this together. So appreciate you joining us, and that's going to do it for this episode of Chasing the Cup. We're going to have some more content for you later on next week. We're going to be joined by Ryan O'Hearn, so looking forward to that conversation here on Chasing the Cup. If you like what you're hearing from us this year, be sure and rate and review the show. If you're not subscribing to Chasing the Cup, you can do so on Apple, Google, and Spotify.
Chasing the Cup is recorded in the Bearcat Sports Network studios in the new Wood Forest Athletic Center. This week's episode was written and produced by Jason Barfield. Broadcast calls are courtesy ESPN. The songs Hot Shot and Clear Progress are courtesy ScottHolmesMusic.com. This has been a presentation of the Bearcat Sports Network.